I'm Matt Galloway, and this is The Current.
This is Felicia, my wig. My father used to say, you always hide behind your hair. I always had very, very long hair. I've never been one that's very creative with my hair. It's always been the same length. The moment they told me I was going to lose my hair was devastating, and it started falling out of my head in chunks.
Tracy Beamish is 42 years old. She lives in Halifax and was diagnosed with breast cancer 3 years ago. Naming her wig Felicia for a laugh was just one of the ways she said she survived that ordeal. It wasn't the cancer that she found most difficult. It was the treatment, chemotherapy, and 25 rounds of radiation.
It was probably one of the most horrifying things in my life. Never in my life did I ever understand the word fatigue. My home at the time had three levels, and I had to stop halfway up my first level of stairs and couldn't make it. I had to take a break. You'd be watching things on television, and they call it chemo fog, and you lose your ability to pay attention. You're just in this almost fog throughout this treatment that the medicine knocks you out. The thought of ever having to go through chemo again would terrify me.
Tracy Beamish is now in remission and feeling positive about her health, but stories like hers are familiar to Azra Raza. She is an oncologist who's watched thousands of patients and her own husband suffer from both the disease and the treatment, and she'd like to see the whole system change. Dr. Raza is a professor of medicine at Columbia University and the author of The First Cell and the Human Cost of Pursuing Cancer to the Last. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning, Matt.
What do you think when you hear stories like that one from Tracy Beamish about what she's been through and how she coped or tried to cope with the treatment that she received?
The primary rule of medicine is first do no harm. And it's absolutely horrifying to hear Beamish's story, and something that I see multiple times a day for the last 35 years. What she described is so true, because it's literally like, as someone said, taking a baseball bat and hitting a dog with it to get rid of its fleas. That's how bad the treatment we are currently using it to treat cancer is. What is really most ghastly and unbelievable to me is that I landed in America in 1977, started treating a bone marrow cancer, acute myeloid leukemia. We were using two drugs, popularly known as 7 and 3. Today in 2020, I'm using the exact same two drugs with the exact same dreadful results.
Are the results the more difficult thing for the patient to cope with, or is it the disease itself? Because there's the moment of diagnosis and that relaying of bad news, but as you're describing it, the baseball bat can be horrifying and incredibly debilitating as well.
It's not just the diagnosis, which carried its own stigma of having cancer and its own scary and life-threatening consequences that one imagines, but the treatment makes things even more grisly. And the problem is that not only are we continuing to give the same treatment despite hundreds of billions of dollars spent in trying to find new drugs for the last 60 years. We even don't know how these drugs work when they work. For example, what is the exact mechanism of action of tamoxifen, the most commonly used therapy in breast cancer? Mm. Nobody knows precisely how these things. We think we know that it's going to kill the cell or it's going to modify the behavior of that. But really, the knowledge is lacking completely. So the idea is that we have now a situation where we are curing 68% of cancers that are newly diagnosed. That's great news. But it's not because we are using or have developed any grand new therapies. Most of it is still being treated with chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and surgery, what I call the slash poison and burn approach. We have seen a decline in mortality from cancer, 1% a year, which is nothing to write home about, but it's still it's better than nothing because in the last three decades, that means we have dropped the cancer mortality by 26%. But once again, it's not because we are finding any great new therapies. It's because of two things. One, because of anti-smoking campaigns began to show some results. And two, because we are diagnosing cancer earlier and earlier and instituting therapy earlier. And everyone knows that if there is a diagnosis of cancer, the first thing people say is, oh, but don't worry, it was found early, so it's curable.
In the book, you write that this is an embarrassment. And you use very strong language. You've used that language already in our conversation. Why would you say that the lack of progress is an embarrassment?
Because why are we not looking at the entire overall picture and trying to do something different instead of repeating the same old? This is why it's an embarrassment. Why haven't we been able to do better for acute myeloid leukemia, for example? The reason is that the disease is horrendously complicated and it's a moving target. So all cancers begin in a single cell. When this cell divides into two new cells, it is likely to make more DNA copying errors, which normally occur in cells as they divide, but because cancer cells are dividing faster and faster, they make more errors, which can translate how it responds to therapy. So potentially it's two new cancers every time a leukemia cell is dividing into two. So why do we think, what gives us great confidence then that trying to reproduce this disease in animals, healthy animals who don't get it spontaneously, and then testing drugs against this artificially produced cancer will work when it's extrapolated to humans? What is giving us this confidence for the last 50, 60 years?
And yet, I mean, in light of what you're saying, we will often see headlines. I mean, it's almost daily or weekly that you'll see them in the newspaper saying that there has been an extraordinary breakthrough in treatment of some form of cancer. Are you suggesting that the headlines and the stories behind the headlines aren't true?
I'm not suggesting, I'm declaring that they are absolutely, most of them are false. So there are two main explanations for this kind of delusional headlines. The first is that even improvement in survival by a matter of weeks is proclaimed from the rooftops as if it's a game changer. Under pressure from advocacy groups, from patients, the FDA in America is willing to approve a drug if it improves survival by as little as 2.5 months. You tell me, if a 22-year-old has cancer, what does 2.5 month survival improvement mean to that person, especially when it comes with horrendous side effects? And a second important reason is the fine print will always show something like new drug curing pancreatic cancer. And then in the fine print, it will be in mice.
And you don't believe that there, I mean, if something is cured in mice, it certainly doesn't mean that it's cured in human beings.
Well, these drugs that we find, which are curative in animals, we bring them to the patient's bedside, and 95% of these drugs fail. The 5% that get approved should have failed because they're doing precious little and financially ruining people.
And yet there is a huge cohort within the medical community that will say that progress is being made. Dr. Len Lichtenfeld is the Deputy Chief Medical Officer for the American Cancer Society. Have a listen to what he says about advances in research and in treatment.
I certainly can agree that for some cancers, we have not made much progress. However, we've averted close to 3 million premature deaths from cancer over the past 27 years. That's nothing to be ignored. We can do better, but let's not ignore that we have had success. We have put a tremendous amount of research effort, tremendous amount of research dollars in stimulating new ideas so we can have new approaches to reduce the burden of cancer. But it's true, for every successful drug, there are 8 or 9 drugs that have not been successful in clinical trials. But that doesn't mean the research has failed. That doesn't mean that everything we do up to that point is necessarily flawed. It's also fair to say that our more traditional treatments have had some success, and our ability to screen for cancer is not something to be ignored. A tremendous amount of effort has gone to finding the first cell, to finding the first signals of cancer, and then deciding how best to treat it. Billions of dollars are being spent right now as we speak, and we are making progress in that arena. So I think it's a little presumptuous to say that all we're doing is poisoning people or burning people or cutting people.
Azra Raza, what do you make of that?
I agree with him completely. We are curing 68% of patients, and that's nothing to be frowned at.
But he seems to be looking at the glass a bit more half full than half empty.
I know this is the issue that people are quite... So a family friend of ours once told my younger brother that if the sun rose from the west today, everybody will stop and stare at it and wonder why. But then there are some people who watch the sun rise in the east every day and wonder why. I want to bring to attention all that we have been taking for granted. Why in this day and age of supreme technology are we using such primitive measures still to treat cancer? So where have all the billions of dollars gone that are being invested to develop new therapies? Everything we bring to the bedside literally has just petered out into disappointment. So I'm not saying we haven't developed most fantastic biologic insights into the pathology of cancer. Of course we have. I'm not saying all the research is wasted. Of course it isn't. I completely agree with Dr. Lichtenfeld in everything he's saying. And yes, a lot of money is being spent in finding the first cell, but not enough. I understand we have patients we have to treat today, so we can't give up doing all the things that we are trying to do for them. All I'm asking is, what about future patients? One in two men and one in three women are going to get cancer. Are we going to continue on this path of slash poison burn and keep thumping our chests and giving ourselves gold medals? Of course, nobody is trying to denigrate what has been done until now, but how can we do better? The only thing that seems to work is identifying cancer early. I'm saying, why aren't we using the latest technology to try and identify cancer at its inception?
You write in the book about a number of patients that you have encountered over the course of your career. One of them happens to be your husband, Harvey, who is also an oncologist. How prepared were you for what he had to go through after his diagnosis?
I had already been treating cancer patients for 20 years almost. And yet, until I shared a bed with a patient, I had no idea how deeply painful this disease can be.
What do you mean?
I mean literal pain. There is almost no organ or tissue that was not affected by pain in Harvey's case. He suffered such scorching, blistering episodes of wrecking pain. It was just unbelievable. His body was completely ravaged, and even he was shocked being an oncologist. The tolls that cancer takes at so many levels, one of them being that no sooner did you get adapted to one new condition, things change radically. The agonizing combat that we saw between cancer cells, the immune system trying to fight it, the treatments we are giving, it all becomes so confusing.
I was going to say, I mean, between that and watching your daughter's best friend, Andrew, go through his experience with a tumor that was on his spinal cord, he's just in his 20s and he dies just over a year and a bit after he's diagnosed. As somebody who sees this close up, what is it like to know of the disease and know so much about the disease, but also watch somebody in the grips of the disease?
Matt, this is what brought home the whole issue to me in one fell swoop. When Andrew woke up from anesthesia and turned to his mother and said, "Don't worry about it, just call Ezra, she's on the cutting edge, she's going to find the cure." In that moment, I realized how badly we have failed the Andrews of this world. We have no right to go around prancing and posturing about all the wonderful things we are doing for cancers as long as there's even one Andrew dying this miserable death. every oncologist knew from day zero that this poor boy's chances of survival are 0.00. The second level at which we failed him is kept offering him confusing treatments. You can take this, you don't have to take this. Why are we offering even these choices to a 22-year-old? And then in the midst of all this, Matt, you see the expression of human nobility. You experience grace in the presence of someone like Andrew. 2 weeks before, this poor young man at 23 years of age is dying. They brought to him a form to sign that is called a do not resuscitate form, which means that if he stops breathing, they will not do anything about it, or does he want them to intubate? And he immediately told them to go away. He's not going to sign it. But that evening, his father came to the hospital to relieve the mother and sister who had been there all day. Andrew, as soon as his father was alone with him, called the people back, signed the form saying, I could not do it in front of my mother. She wouldn't be able to take it. This 23-year-old who is dying is protective of his mother. This is a moment of grace that humbles you like nothing else can.
What did your daughter want from you, not as a mom, but as a doctor and a cancer expert, when it came to the situation that her best friend found himself in?
My daughter, Andrew, and Scheherazade's other friends, they were all so confused. Andrew's mother and grandmother have survived cancer. How is he dying at 22? And Scheherazade pointedly told me once in the middle of the night when she called almost hysterical, she said, Mom, I heard all my life that you and Dad helped cancer patients, but you're not helping Andrew. Why?
It's a sobering moment for not just a doctor, but for a mother.
I decided I have to really now double my efforts. Back in 1984, I turned my attention to trying to find cases at the pre-leukemic state and try to prevent the appearance of this end-stage terminal monstrosity called acute myeloid leukemia by intercepting it early. So this is not something that I just decided to say after I experienced the ghastly scenes with Andrew. Mm. This is something I have been saying repeatedly since 1984 and trying to do it, not just saying it. I started banking cells from my patients, and today I have a tissue repository with 60,000 samples in it. And this tissue repository has yielded a huge number of insights. What has become very clear is that going after one gene, studying one pathway or two pathways in a few patients, this reductionist approach is not working. What we need is a more pluralistic approach, by which I mean try to use the latest technologies, ways of studying the proteins and the genome of the cell, and then all the imaging and scanning devices we have, redirecting our funds and our resources in such a way that it brings the competition that was seen during the landing of man on the moon between America and Russia, and the cooperation that was seen between scientists around the world doing the Human Genome Project.
As you say, we're in some ways looking at the last cells. If you want to get to the first cancer cell, how do you get at that? What are the technologies that might offer some promise that you say are already almost on our doorstep?
The fact is that it's very clear that treatment alone is not going to be sufficient to address the cancer problem. We need to develop techniques just like vaccines, just like we have for prevention for infectious disease. We will need to find preventive measures. How do we do it? Well, this is where I am asking for redirection of funds being wasted in doing useless clinical trials or trials that are yielding a 5% success rate to trying to develop, for example, ways of finding the presence of cancer in any secretion through a liquid biopsy, blood, sweat, saliva, tears, urine. You know that Toshiba just announced last month that from one drop of blood, with 99% confidence, they can now detect the presence of 13 different common types of cancers just based on detection of microRNA signatures that they have identified.
And when could you start that testing? How early in life?
This test can start from birth to death. And why are we, why are we only using screening measures on a once-a-year basis and screening measures that were developed 50 years ago? We should be using these kinds of sophisticated technologies to monitor the human body continuously from birth to death.
And you don't worry about the cost or the concerns that people raise around issues of false positives and that could create more strain, not just on the healthcare system, but on the mental health of those patients who are being tested?
Of course I worry about it. And of course there'll be a lot of overdiagnosis and overtreatment. Isn't there now? And yes, finding that you have early cancer present in your body can be very scary emotionally. But then if we have a solution for treatment of that early cancer, then it won't remain that scary. So I think all this will co-evolve simultaneously. That is, once we find that this is actually a potentially lethal threat to the body, only then are we going to direct some kind of treatment. The many treatments that are failing today may be because they are being used when the disease is far too advanced.
I want to ask you about that word death. Often the stories that we will hear of cancer are the stories of survivors, and those are used in inspirational ways. They're used for fundraising. They're used to generate hope among those who would be facing a bleak diagnosis. Why did you want to tell the stories of patients who died?
It was not to revel in their suffering or pain. The reason I told the stories of patients who died is to bring the patients back into every conversation about cancer front and center, and to look at everything through the prism of human anguish. I have interviewed patient families, sometimes 10 years after they lost a beloved member. Probably the most important part of the book is the voice of these families. A mother of a 22-year-old Andrew saying that even if there was a 1 in a million chance, we would have taken it. And we would not give up doing everything that we did because they are mothers.
This is hard reading, though, and there's a lot in the book that, I mean, given the prevalence of these diseases, can drive people down, can make people feel as though it is bleak, that the outlook is not optimistic. Where do you find hope in the work that you do?
Well, I'm very optimistic, and in fact, this is not a gloom and doom book. Yes, I have written about the patients who have died, but also there are twice as many stories of the patients who are alive and who have defied all odds. The idea is to also tell cancer patients that you are not alone. Most of us are at risk of getting cancer tomorrow, and that there are hundreds of thousands of amazing researchers and amazing oncologists who are working very, very hard to try and find a solution. So it should bring a modicum of relief to the people who are anxious about it. And it would be the best thing for cancer survivors to insist upon more funding and resources being directed towards the identification of the earliest stage of cancer so that they don't have to go through the same thing all over again. I'm 100% sure that we will, in the very near future, have the technology at least to find the earlier footprints of cancers, and that along with that revolution will come better treatment options. So I'm very optimistic.
Dr. Raza, it's great to speak with you about this. This is it's powerful reading and so familiar to so many of us who have friends and family who have gone through this. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Azra Raza is an oncologist and the author of The First Cell and The Human Cost of Pursuing Cancer to the Last. She was in New York.